Everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. We're coming to you a few days earlier because we are departing for the Australian Open. But our guest this week is a good one, a great one. It is the inimitable, incomparable Mary Carrillo. You know her work, of course, from a variety of outlets, including Tennis Channel, HBO Real Sports, NBC Olympics. You will get Mary on all three of those outlets in the next few weeks. We talk a bit about the Australian Open, where she'll be appearing for Tennis Channel. She has a piece on Real Sports airing January 30th that pertains to Margaret Court and some of her controversial views. And then Mary's headed directly to South Korea for the Winter Olympics, her 14th Olympic Games. This is a fun, free-flowing conversation. You, of course, know Mary, and she's been a third time she's appeared on this podcast. This is an hour of just tennis talk, and it jumps around a bunch and doesn't have necessarily a linear or structured approach, but I think you'll enjoy it. So here's an hour with Mary Carrillo previewing the 2018 Australian Open. Happy New Year, my friend. John Wertheim.
Hello. Hey, John. How are you, man?
Oh, all good. You?
I'm good.
You know, I was thinking, you are a third-time guest. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. I always fun to spend time with you. Remember last year we did this in a hotel room over coffee?
Yeah, I do remember that.
let's start with Real Sports, though. Because okay. You are not going to be back here to publicize this, but the first Real Sports of 2018, one of the segments, you and Margaret Court.
Yes.
Why?
Well, the pitch to Real Sports that I made was not necessarily about Margaret Court. The pitch was, when is a legacy safe? You know, here's Margaret Court, who's won more Grand Slam titles than any man or woman, 62 of them, 24 of them that came in singles. And she's had all kinds of honors. She's a Hall of Famer. You know all this stuff. The third largest arena at the Australian Open is named after her. But, you know, there are people who think her name should be stripped from that 7,500-seat arena because of her very strong views as a Pentecostal minister. You know, she is very forthcoming about gay marriage. She's totally against it. She talks a lot about transgender kids and how dangerous that is. She talks about a genderless society that ours is becoming, about a fatherless generation. She has taken swings that, of all people, women tennis players.
Right.
You know, and so I spent a week with Margaret Court in Perth, Australia. She gave us a great, generous amount of time. We interviewed her for 4 days. We went to the Ministry Life Center, which is very impressive. She does tremendous work, John. I mean, it's like a campus, this place in Perth. There's four separate buildings. She gives out 24 tons of food a week to 650 families. There are people there trying to overcome all manner of addictions. There are people there that we interviewed that claim that they have been healed. Margaret also thinks that homosexuality can be overcome if that's what you want to do. So I not only interviewed Margaret, I then went to Miami and Real Sports interviewed Martina Navratilova, and you can imagine the reaction she had to some of the things I quoted back to her that Margaret said. And then we went to New York and interviewed Billie Jean King, who will be at the Australian Open this year, and who in fact will present the women's champion with the trophy. Billie Jean King will be doing that. It's obviously the 50th anniversary of open tennis.
Right.
Billie Jean will be there, in fact, for the whole 2 weeks. Margaret has already decided that, and she told me she wouldn't be going to the Australian Open this year. She says that that's not the reason. She said that she goes to the Australian Open and Wimbledon. Those are the two majors she continues to attend with some kind of regularity, but she's skipping it this year. And frankly, it will be very interesting, won't it, when we get to Australia and we find out, you know, now that I was with Margaret Court on the day that gay marriage passed in Australia. And she feels that, she continues to feel, even though 7.8 million people voted for gay marriage, and it passed, Margaret Court continues to feel that she is part of a silent majority. And I will tell you, without giving away too much of of this real sports piece that's coming up, when I said that to Martina, she exclaimed, "The majority is never silent."
There's a lot to unpack there. But did you?
Yes.
Did you reach a conclusion? I mean, you raise a question.
It's interesting. You know, obviously I have a lot of strong feelings. Margaret was an idol of mine. Martina and Billie Jean are two more idols of mine. A lot of people. Margaret claims that half of her ministry doesn't even know that she was a great Grand Slam tennis champion. And Margaret obviously has had a much lower profile than both Billie Jean and Martina. I am tempted to agree with a lot of the things that Billie and Martina say about Margaret Court, about how dangerous some of her views can be, how it can create a lot of bullying and all that. But I also witnessed firsthand how much good Margaret does. And, you know, again, we go back to the idea of, when is a legacy safe? Should Pete Rose be in the Hall of Fame? Tom Yawkey, the Red Sox owner for 44 years of the Boston Red Sox, he was long accused of racism because he didn't have any blacks on his team. When he finally got in Pumpsy Green in 59, it was 12 years after every other team had already been inviting blacks. I mean,
right. But what about the
Yawkey way to get? I mean, when is it okay? You know, when Margaret Court is, and here's the hell of it, John. Ironically, it was Billie Jean King who fought, was very vocal for a long time to the Australian Tennis Federation that they should name a stadium after Margaret. You know, Rod Laver is a great champion, and no one has a problem with anything Rod Laver has ever done in his whole life, but Margaret Court was a bigger champion. So, I mean, the whole point, what I hope happens if people watch this story is at the end of it, they've got a lot on their mind. And they have to decide, when is it, you know, especially in the current political climate where there are people who want, you know, statues taken down, you know, Confederate war heroes. And
but isn't there a critical difference here that we're not talking about historical sensitivity? We're not talking about Confederate monuments. We're talking about someone who presently they acted offensively in retrospect, that someone right now, in present tense, holds views that are offensive to so many people. Doesn't that sort of change the analysis?
I don't know about that. I mean, I know that there's a Joe Paterno, the Penn State scandal. You know, the reason that statue came down is because a lot of people felt like, even though he had not done these terrible things to boys in the locker room, he was complicit. He knew about it. Sure. Margaret Court has not done anything criminal, has she? Her views, again, can be abhorrent to many people, but it's free speech, right? But I mean, that's where it gets subtle and nuanced and tricky. I want people to watch this thing and at the end not be sure exactly how they feel one way or another.
I don't want to give away too much of the episode, but I think it's a really smart way of approaching it to frame this not as necessarily Margaret Court, but this sort of broader question. But what one of my big things with Margaret Court and in general with what I will call homophobia is the lack of symmetry. There's so many issues where somebody gains and someone else loses, and we're talking about splitting up a pie. On this one, you are causing pain, and you know, you are causing injury and offense, and you don't suffer any in response. I mean, if I love the expression, like, if you don't like gay marriage, don't get gay married. But does she have any recognition of the fact that there are a lot of people she's hurting with her views, especially when she makes them public?
Well, you're echoing so much of what Martina says. You know, Martina feels that when Margaret goes public with these stances, you know, kids get bullied. You know, people get bullied for this.
Right.
Margaret Court claims that she is the one who gets bullied, that she says what she believes, and she says, these are not my words, these are the Lord's. She's basically saying, I am just going by what the good book says. You know, I have taken you know, Jesus Christ, our Lord, into my life. This is what he feels. So she says, I'm getting bullied. And she feels strongly that she has a lot of strong feelings. But one of them is that there is this big gay American wealthy gay push, that monies are coming into Australia from wealthy gay Americans. And that is why the whole gay rights movement has picked up so much traction in Australia. So she says, I'm getting bullied. That's a hell of a thing to, that's a hell of an argument to be making.
Well, yeah, I was going to say.
She says, and she also says, John, she says it's all about the children. She says that over and over again. She feels that if you confuse children by saying, you could be a boy, you could be a girl, you don't need a father, you don't need a nuclear family, you know. She says all that is very confusing to children, and she's just trying to make the world safer for children.
Sounds like Maude Flanders. Someone said to me, they said,
let me ask you this question.
Right.
What if the thing that Margaret gets famous for, or it wasn't about gay marriage or about the dangers of transgenderism. What if the big thing she was against was abortion? Would we be having this conversation? Would there be people saying, take her name off of that stadium?
I think abortion we've come to accept as an issue where we can take a side, but we understand the legitimacy of the other side. This just seems gratuitous, and all, I mean, it flies in the face of social science. I mean, to me, abortion is a valid issue, and I think people recognize it as you can agree to disagree. This just seems gratuitously painful. But you know, someone asked me. They said, you know, are we going to see protest, or have these athletes today just forgotten about it? And I wonder, do you think that, you know, as you say, marriage equality in Australia passes by overwhelming amounts. We have sitcom. I mean, I think we've evolved so much on this issue. Is this just sort of Margaret Court sadly become this baddie woman with these retrograde views that's now going to eclipse what she achieved in tennis? Or do you think this is something that really needs to be sort of relitigated every year when she makes her annual appearance to talk about the lesbians and the gay conspiracy? And I don't have it in front of me. I don't remember the language, but it strikes me as crazy talk that almost doesn't merit a serious response. I don't know how you feel about that, but have we moved on past this, or do you think we need to have a demonstration at Margaret Court Arena at the Australian Open this year?
Well, my sense of things is that on the Friday before the Australian Open starts, there in fact will be the tennis facility will be open to sort of something that sounds sort of like a gay pride day. And I think that's probably, I think, look, here's the other issue, John, which you're very aware of. Margaret Court Arena has its own separate ticket. So if there are players who don't want to play on that court,
right,
if there are fans who don't want to sit in that court and watch tennis matches, that becomes an issue as well. Do I think it will become a story, at least in the first week of the Australian Open? Yeah, I do, especially because gay marriage passed. I don't know how much of the New Year's fireworks you watched, but over Sydney Harbour,
yeah, exactly, right.
There were rainbow colors coming off of the bridge. I mean, I think that it's a continuing story. And again, the irony of it all is that a lot of the remarks that can be construed to be very offensive are about women tennis players. You know, she claims that, you know, women's tennis is full of lesbians. She does not say that happily, that that lesbians took young ones into parties. Wait till you hear Martina react to that statement. That she said years ago that she didn't feel Martina was a role model because she was gay. She went after Casey DeLacqua.
But that's exactly my point.
For having children without having a father.
This is offensive talk that causes pain. This isn't taking a side on an issue that some people may find disagree. I mean, this is, to me, she's surrendered her boarding pass. Goodbye.
It will be interesting. Do you think they're going to take her name off of that arena?
I do think we need to differentiate between something that it may have been offensive looking back, like we are with Confederate monuments, where someone, as opposed to someone who today at this moment in time would say these things. But I also think at this point we've almost moved past it, and I don't want to minimize or diminish homophobia, which I think this is, but at the same time we're almost at the point where this is more Grandpa Simpson than something to find threatening. Anyway,
so you don't think it's you're saying you don't think it's going to be a big story at this year's Australia?
I don't necessarily think it is, especially with her not being there. Honestly, someone who I know was displeased by this is Andy Murray, who will not be there. But I also feel like we've moved so far beyond this that it just seems like retrograde blathering more than hate speech. But I think what she says is very offensive. I mean, if you want to have these beliefs, fine. But the way she has consistently articulated them, going after Casey DeLacqua as a mother and a same-sex guy. I mean, I just find these, that what you said about the parties and the lesbian, the crapping on tennis, I just feel like you hold these views, God bless you, but I think the way she's expressed them is really offensive and not something that should be tolerated as, you know, agreeing to disagree. Anyway, but I look forward to this, and I commend you. I think it's a really interesting topic and a good way to animate the topic. So I haven't seen it, but good on you. Let me change subjects with you. You see the Becker documentary?
I have not seen it.
Oh man, I'm dying to talk about that.
Should I see it?
Yeah, it's like 90 minutes. It's on Netflix.
It's in German, right?
Yeah, but there's subtitles. And man, I'm dying to talk about this with someone.
Why? Tell me why.
Because honestly, I did not. He predated me. I mean, I obviously knew him as a fan, but I didn't cover him or anything like that. And I'm sort of curious. I mean, he emerged as a flawed and yet endearing figure. I did not realize the effect of the extent of Tyriac's influence on him. Mm. And I wonder how surprised people are by where we are here with Becker in his early 50s. If this is I can't believe the story is broken this way, or boy, this was predictable. I saw this coming.
Are you talking about his financial woes?
Yeah, just sort of everything. I mean, this is not, and you know, his sister, I mean, this isn't just me. I mean, his own sister says sort of it's heartbreaking what Boris has become, and he's lost his privacy, and the financial woes are obviously part of it. I mean, there are all these stories. You've heard these stories about he would fly to a tournament and have two jets, one for him and one for his luggage. I mean, it sounds like this was not a smart shopper. But I'm kind of grew fast. You know, you talked to him a little about Djokovic, but he always felt like he couldn't really speak. And I think oddly enough, this documentary has all sorts of access, and they follow him into the operating room, and he talks pretty openly about his finances. And there's maybe two words about Djokovic, which I would argue is sort of the most relevant thing Becker's done. Yeah, the guy's coached a multiple time Grand Slam champion, and that got very little. Clearly, one of the conditions was I'll do this, but not a lot of Djokovic talk. But I'm dying to talk to someone who knew him.
I will watch it, and I will report back to you.
All right, but what about the fundamental? I mean, are you surprised by how this story is broken?
Which story? Becker story?
Yeah, Becker is 50 years old and financial trouble and limping and
no. Not really. Guy's had a lot of complicated relationships in his life. It sounds like he's had tax issues. I mean, it's kind of the story of a lot of athletes, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I wish I could say that it did surprise me, but no. I always heard he was a very, you know, a lot of guys, you know, you hear about Kafelnikov's gambling and how much trouble he got into it. Andre Medvedev is gambling, another Russian, Becker, you know, that these are high-stakes games that I think my sense of things when you hear about Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods and the money they throw down in Las Vegas, whatever, I have a feeling that athletes, great athletes, they get used to highs. They get used to the exhilaration of throwing it all down, putting it on a line. When they can't do it physically, they try to find some other way to do it. And a lot of times you can get in real trouble if you go that way. So no, I cannot say that. I think he's a complicated fellow, Boris Becker, and an interesting one. But no, I can't say that it's a surprise.
They follow him into a casino. I'll have you know. And you know what? Yeah. I smell a real sports segment. Athletes trying to replicate the high of competition by playing in front of big stacks of poker chips.
I also think it's why a lot of former athletes get into drugs. You know, they the highs that they created with their own hard work and discipline and you know, when they miss it. I think it's something that they truly miss, in the same way that, you know, there can be a gambling high, and right. So they try to find it in other ways that can be very destructive.
This is a family podcast, but I would add that there's a sex dimension to that as well.
Absolutely,
there's a reason. Yeah. That, you know,
there are all kinds of excess that can get you into all kinds of trouble.
I always say this about athletes, and then we'll talk about the Australian Open. It must be such a strange life cycle to have, you know, you're 24, 25, 26 years old, and you have reached your peak earning powers in most cases. You have reached your peak notoriety, your peak exhilaration, and you retire. We talk about these athletes, and they struggle with this retirement decision. I totally get that. You imagine being 30 years old and saying, like, the next 50 years, I'm not going to be able to replicate anything that I've achieved in the first third of my life?
But it's one more reason why I'm so admiring of athletes, that they work
so hard from such
a young age.
Totally.
And the athletic heart is one of my favorite hearts around. I really love the way it beats and how hard it works and how everything means something to them, you know?
It's so funny. Someone said, don't you get jaded by athletes? And I always say the exact opposite. I have more awe and respect for athletes now than, you know, when I started 20 years. It's all the other bullshit, and it's the agents and the handlers, and, like, that's where the cynicism is. The actual athletes themselves, I find more impressed by. Exactly. That's a great word. Exactly. I'll tell you the other thing, too, is don't you feel like the Jims and the Lindsays who are able to successfully make that transition, the Mary Carillas as well, but someone like Jim Courier, who has just, for whatever reason, he's been able to make this really, really graceful transition away from sports and to have other interests and curiosities. Lindsay's the same way. It's really remarkable.
Well, they're very bright. These are intelligent, thoughtful, intellectually curious people. So that really helps. I mean, I never lasted as long in tennis matches when I was a player, you know, as I do at tennis tournaments now.
I
don't include myself in this conversation at all. But I especially like players who want to hang around, who in whatever capacity, whether it's to coach or to help run tournaments or to be on television. Absolutely. Their passion doesn't really diminish. They just move it sideways somehow. I mean, I'm that rare bird who somehow parallel parked her way into a television career. You know?
Oh, stop. You had, again, I feel like the word curiosity, and we can talk about that. It's a word that's come up a lot recently in respect to our president. It's this curiosity, I think, more than intelligence.
Yes.
Is so critical.
Oh, I agree with that. Yes.
You know what they're doing in you know what they're doing in a week? They're starting a Grand Slam. There's going to be a Grand Slam tournament. Let's talk a tiny bit Australian Open.
I'd be happy to. I loved last year's Australian Open. It was my favorite Grand Slam event ever.
I was going to say that could be his, like, the Williams one night followed by a five-setter Federer-Nadal. That's as good as it gets.
Yeah, no, I loved it. And this year will be, obviously there's going to be some very important people missing. I think we have to draw a very clear distinction between, you know, okay, the men are suffering big injuries. Nadal, his knee and his wrist, so it looks like he's going to play.
Right.
Wawrinka out with a knee. Djokovic, who knows if his elbow will be fit enough. Murray's out with a hip. You know, I mean, those are all tennis injuries. You know, and obviously we've had Del Potro and Raonic with their own injuries. But on the women's side, the absences are not. Sharapova was gone for 15 months because She was serving a doping suspension. Kvitova got stabbed in her playing hand. Vika has a custody battle going on. Serena just had a kid a couple of months ago. So
a big one, yeah.
These are notable absences, but you can't. It's apples and oranges comparing the men to the women. The reason that some of the women aren't there, or or have been missing of late, it's not because of overplay. It's, if anything, they've underplayed or not played.
No, I think that's a good distinction. We will see about our U.S. Open champion Sloane Stephens as well.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, the Serena absence obviously has nothing to do with hard courts and playing too many matches in the sun. Though I do, well, did you happen to see what Patrick said about Serena?
Moradoglu said? Yeah, I did.
That was interesting.
I think he's absolutely right. I don't want to watch Serena come back and try to, you know, find her form and lose in the second round trying to defend her title, you know?
Right.
And I never expected her to go to Australia. Frankly, I think the first major she'll really be ready to compete in and win is Wimbledon. I mean, yeah, maybe she'll,
yeah,
I know she's
gonna,
supposed
right,
to play
right.
a lot earlier than that,
right.
and that's fine. But, you know, I see her tying Margaret Court's 24th major record at Wimbledon this year. And that's, I think that'll be a lot of fun to watch. I'm more interested now. Here's Simona Halep, who gets seeded number one.
Good.
For the first time, she gets seeded number one in a major. And keep in mind, last year she lost in the first round of the Australian. So there's a lot of people, I think. I'm glad Belinda Bencic is playing good tennis again.
Right.
It sounds like Kerber's playing well. And on the men's side, there's a lot of young guys that I'm really happy about.
Well,
Stefanos Tsitsipas.
I was going to say, Tsitsipas fever. You've got it too. Let's stick with the women. Stick with the women for a second, though.
All right.
The defending champion.
What do you think?
If I said to you, Caroline Wozniacki, 2018 Australian Open champion, would you
it
concur,
would not be
reject, or modify?
Here's the only reason I would say she's not one of the favorites is because it sounds like the hard courts at the Australian Open are going to carry the same kind of speed they had last year. And that was a nice, fast court.
Yeah,
and
that
rewards, I think, bigger hitters than Wozniacki.
Right.
So, but, I mean, the fact that Caroline ended 2017 as well as she did was, I mean, I would love to see her win just one stinking major before she goes.
she's done her time.
I don't have a problem. I'd like to see it. I truly wish that Simona Halep wins her first major in 2018. She's a nice girl. She works hard. She's had some absolutely heart-wrenching losses. And I think she deserves it. I really do. I want to see Muguruza play well. I want to see Joe Conta be fit enough to really challenge. There's a lot of I'm kind of into this. I must say I'm kind of happy with the way things are shaken out.
It is a wide open, it's a wide open frontier. We will see what Conestoga wagon makes it through seven rounds. What about the we have not mentioned she's 37 years old, but we have not mentioned the defending runner up.
That's true. Why discount Venus? I mean, she did. You could make the case that she had a better Grand Slam season than just about anybody last year, though she didn't win one.
Right.
She got deep into two of them, and again, if that court is going to play the same way this year as it played last year, that's going to reward her game.
Never won the Australian
Open. It's fun.
It is fun. I mean, Madison Keys is coming off
a
final at the last major. We got options here.
We got options here. We can keep talking about the women, but that Rafa Nadal has only won this thing once. This is the only major where Rafa has not won it multiple times.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I will talk men, but I always say about that last Rafa's up 3-1 in the fifth set last year, and apart from everything else, you're right, if he wins that match he will have won every major multiple times. That whatever it is, 25 minute interval from Rafa serving, from Rafa up 3-1 in the fifth set to Rafa failing to close is one of these intervals that's gonna 50 years from now, that will be a pivotal interval in tennis history.
Yeah, I think so. And but the fact is, but then Rafa went on and won two more majors last year anyway. So, I mean, look, last year, you know, we were wondering if Rafa and Roger were going to be able to get back the form that had gotten them so great, and they both had career years. I mean, this year, last year at this time, you know, Andy Murray was number one in the world. Novak Djokovic was right behind him. And those two are, I don't know if Djokovic is going to play in Australia. I know Andy, I feel badly for Andy because it sounds for all the world like he was hoping that this torn labrum of his wasn't going to require surgery. So he did everything he could to avoid surgery. And now it sounds like he's got to get in. He's got to get under the knife anyway. That's a real pity. And it sounds like Djokovic's elbow problem. You know, he tried to do everything to avoid surgery on that thing. I understand that. But I think to myself, man, what? Maybe these guys, you know, played the long game instead of getting cut and being on the men quicker. But again, what do I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, so
that's how I feel.
A year ago, what'd you say? I mean, I have extreme views about these injuries. I mean, I feel like sport of a lifetime is suddenly perhaps a slogan in need of reassessment. But where are you in terms of just, it's a physical sport and athletes get hurt. And, you know, I mean, I like the Indianapolis Colts and they didn't have their quarterback because he got hurt. I mean, injuries are part of sports, but I think there's just, it's sort of emperor's new clothes. I mean, everyone's carried away with whether we're going to have electronic line calls and we're going to have, you know, no ad scoring and doubles. And meanwhile, there's a very, what I think is this existential issue of you just don't have a healthy field. And
well, and I think, again, this is a, you know me well, you know, I have a lot of half-baked theories, but one of my half-baked theories on the hip injuries and the wrist injuries is I just think that open stance ground strokes have created these kind of problems. You know, players more and more, even in, you know, in the wake of all of the string technology, the racket technology, everyone's trying to hug the baseline as tight as can be.
Right.
And you don't really have time to set up the way you used to, where you actually rotated your hips and your shoulders. You just got, you know, and used, you know, your big muscle systems in those ways. And now you're putting stress on smaller bones and muscles, like in the wrist, in the elbow. The hips are taking a beating, I think, from open stance ground strokes. And because of the ferocity, the velocity of the ball, a lot of people, you know, they can still get to some balls, but then they're hurting their wrists trying to do it, or their elbows or whatever. I do think that you have to follow the trends of the sport stroke-wise, you know, the mechanics of the sport
totally,
to figure out,
right.
You know? I mean, I have to just sort of jump back to Margaret Court for a second. I was picking her brain on tennis. I mean, this is a woman who, I said to her, you know, she's not that crazy about modern-day women's tennis because she thinks it's kind of boring. And here's another one of my half-baked theories. I honestly feel that Cervenbali, the destroyer of Cervenbali tennis, was a two-handed backhand. Because when I was a kid, boy, oh, boy, was I taught, you know, you serve into someone's backhand,
yeah, right.
You
they
come to the net, you pick off the volley.
Right, exactly.
But anyway, so I proposed this idea to Margaret. And clearly, she had never heard anything like it before. But I think she kind of dug it. I think she kind of gave it a bit of a think and said, yeah, that could be a pretty good reason why you can't serve them all. I mean, who the hell wants to serve into somebody's big backhand?
No, they say you're almost better off with a slower. But no, exactly. You watch this old footage. What do? You serve into the backhand. They give you some one-handed chip. You've got time to take that extra step. Big difference between that.
Pick it off at the net.
Exactly. I just... here's a little tangent for you, but you worked with Dick.
Okay.
Dick Ebersol, right? You worked with Dick Ebersol.
I did.
So
I
he asked me one time. He said, "Tell me what's unique about the Concord." And this was a great logic question. I didn't know the answer, but his response was, "This was one of the few times. Name me another time in history where you had technology, and it was rejected." That. You used to have this ability to get from London to New York or from Paris to New York in whatever it was, 4 hours. And
Yeah.
We reversed, and now it takes longer to get from Europe to New York than it did 20 years ago.
Correct.
His point was, you know, it's seldom that we go backwards. This is a rare outlier. Is tennis prepared, this brings me to technology. I mean, is tennis prepared to say, you know what, all of this Luxalon string and all of these rackets that precipitate these open stances and that do away with slice returns, is tennis prepared to basically reverse technology and undo progress and revert?
No.
All right, so it's
no. No. I can put me down for an emphatic no, especially, I mean, are you just talking about in the professional game or for club players? And
yeah, well, I mean, that's the other thing, too. But if this equipment isn't just restricted to pros, but I'm saying if God forbid tennis actually put some, instead of people like you and me, no, but instead of everyone has a speculation, everyone has an idea, and the athletes overtrain, and they're all, it's hardcore. If someone actually did a longitudinal study, well-funded, peer-reviewed, why are these players getting hurt? And they came back with,
right,
it all starts with the racket and strings, which I think is absolutely right. Do you think tennis would ever say, you know what, we need to somehow ban the material that we've been using now?
Well, as someone who's about to embark on my 14th Olympic Games, right after the Australian, I'm heading to Pyeongchang. Every sport has equipment upgrades. Every single sport, whether it's skis or skates or the luge or whatever, everyone's always trying to find a material that is stronger, that is lighter, that is more flexible, that is stiffer. So to ask tennis to take a step back, I think is, I just cannot imagine. I wouldn't mind it. I mean, baseball, you know, wooden bats in Major League Baseball. I mean, there are sports that are clever enough to understand that, you know, if we want to keep the game singularly beautiful and complicated and subtle or whatever it is
sport. I mean, that to me, it's not about the aesthetics. I mean, all this flexible, softer material is great, but if the three of the five best men's players are missing a slam for the second straight time, we got problems.
I remember, it goes back to Gustavo Kuerten winning the French Open for the first time. With those strings he used, and I remember at the time Andre Agassi saying that should be illegal.
Exactly, it's cheating. Exactly, exactly.
It's like cheating, right? But guess what? A lot of professional tennis players are using that stuff, and I'd be very surprised. First of all, you're right. Facts would be good. Facts, data,
crazy
research,
crazy
would be. It would be a lovely thing. I'm not sure if that's ever going to happen in a real way. But I would love to think that if you can deliberately, very factually point to something that is causing injuries.
I just think it's...
That players have to accommodate their own strokes to live with the current technology. And that's what's causing injuries.
I can
see, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. Do you?
I think this is Emperor's New Clothes stuff. I mean, I just, for as much time as spent on 20 seconds versus 25 seconds and the bounce, I mean, something is gone, something is distressingly wrong here, and nobody really wants to, as long as they're giving out trophies on the second Sunday, everyone's happy, but boy.
But also, I think you also have to keep in mind that the lighter frames, the livelier strings, they keep a lot of tennis players who don't do it to make money. You know, club players, whatever, it makes it easier for them. It makes kids' rackets lighter, bigger. There's all kinds of ways in which by progressing it, you know, and by changing up equipment, it makes it easier for older people to continue to love the game. It makes younger kids, you know, you have to take it all. And that's why when, you know, all these rule changes come about and all right, we're not playing let's anymore. I'm thinking, wait, so that's across the board?
You hate
like
this stuff.
Women's doubles, like club tennis, they have to play let's now? These women who've got like, you know, knee braces on and stuff, they've got to hustle up and try to play a let ball. Like, where, what are we talking about when we talk about sweeping changes, you know?
Yeah,
I just think that they've got to be thoughtful. They've got to make sense. in real ways, not just because, hey, I have an idea. The American concentration focus level has gone way down, so let's speed everything up.
Yeah, but, you know, I play basketball every Saturday, and we play to 11, and the court isn't regulation size. And I mean, I feel like we can. It's funny. I was just
that's
reading
what I mean. Yeah, but that's fine. That's how you accommodate according to either your talent level or your age or you know, or the facility you're using. That's what I'm saying. It's got to be sensible. Right. That's all. I wouldn't mind a little sense every now and then, just for the.
Then it
just for the hell of it.
I was just reading a story about Vienna, and they had this great line about how Vienna is what it is because Austrians will always favor tradition over innovation. Sometimes I fear tennis goes the same way. All right, so real quick, so is Roger winning this thing again?
He's, to my mind, the favorite. Absolutely. He's a favorite. I don't know if he's going to win it again, but I don't see anybody in better form. I'm digging Grigor Dimitrov.
You are.
There's a guy. I like him. There are some people I just really like anyway.
Right.
And that Grigor was able to finish the year behind only Nadal and Federer in 2017, and that he's playing such nice looking tennis in 2018. There are guys I root for. He's one of them. Andy Murray. Some guys have my number. You know,
I hear you.
Whether it's on the court or off the court.
Right.
And so yeah, I think Roger for sure is a favorite. I'm still not sure how wonky Rafa's knee is. I hope he's good, but, you know, it's hard to know, man. It's hard to know with some of these guys.
I guess every other day cuts one way, best of five cuts another. I can't remember. I feel like maybe I talked about this on the podcast. You know what I love about Dimitrov? Maybe I talked about this. Maybe I would. But you ever see there was a gag video during the World Tour Finals in London where Ryan Harrison is asking ridiculous.
I did.
You know, you ever remember when like Bruno, when Sacha Baron Cohen plays Bruno and he almost gets beat up every other episode because people, they're asking Grigor Dimitrov these ridiculous questions and he's too nice a guy to say, you know what, this isn't professional. You know what, one more and then I'm out of here. Yeah. And he's sitting there and I'm thinking that actually was really interesting insight into, what you know,
I
completely
know
unscripted, but anyway.
Yeah, no. He was so tolerant, and he's like that. I give bonus points to any tennis player who can speak three or four languages and is willing to do it at every stinking press conference
too. Right. You're
like, so a guy like Grigor, the fact that he is, I mean, you could tell how loved he is in that locker room. I mean, and I understand why. So I'm hoping he has a big year. Again, there's some young guys I'm hoping throw it down. The fact that I'm and John, you I'm sure you're aware of this. The youngest active men's Grand Slam champions are both 29
it's
years
unbelievable.
Old.
Unbelievable. There was a time until about a year ago when Djokovic, who's, you know, he's going to be 31 this year, was the youngest player to have won a Masters 1000. I mean, it's amazing.
It is, but I mean that Juan Martín Del Potro and Marian Cilic are the youngest active.
Right, Del Potro was 2009.
I'm really, really hoping that, you know, all those players that are in their 20s or even in their late 20s, like Milos Raonic, who might finally have a healthy year in them, you know, or Kei Nishikori, who's missing the Australian again, but hopefully he'll come back. Like there's that lost in the sauce 20s. Group that I hope comes good.
And you know the boys in marketing have passed them by. Now it's, you know,
they had their
two or three years to make hay, and now we've moved on to the next model to roll off the. Now we got the iPhone 8s. But you mentioned
now you've got to be 21 and under.
Exactly.
That's one of the silliest ideas I've ever heard of. 21 and under, really?
Yeah, it's all about the demo. But you mentioned a 19-year-old. I think he's 19. I can look this up. This Stefanos Tsitsipas is. I saw him play.
Digging that guy.
Love that guy, right?
Digging him.
Big boy. Yeah. Big boy.
No. He's going to get bigger and stronger. He'll fill out the way that Sasha Zverev has. I like him a lot. I like this Alex de Minaur a lot. I like Denis Shapovalov a lot.
You do.
Michael Moe looked good too. There's some young guys that. And I don't know, they have a They seem to have, for all the work that they've clearly put in, Rublev as well, they seem to have a playful attitude out there. They're enjoying themselves. That stuff can go away in a hurry.
Right.
we've seen a lot of young players who, by their sophomore year, are looking kind of cranky and crabby. But those guys really seem to, especially Denis Shapovalov for me.
Right.
Shapovalov, I should say. But, this Greek guy, Stefanos Tsitsipas, is going to be a lot of fun. And I'm hoping big things for Nick Kyrgios.
Oh, man. I didn't expect you to
I'm throwing him down.
Really?
I want Nick to have a good year. I still think it would be nice if he thought strongly about getting a coach. But
yeah, he's not. He and Sebastian Grosjean are no more. Wait, can I ask you an honest question among friends?
Please.
Between friends? You and I have talked about this on air. Wait, when did you come around on this guy?
Well, no. When he plays well and means well, I'm on his side every time because of his talent. I mean, I have difficult issues watching him tank or watching him curse or watching him, you know, say stuff to his opponent that you're not even supposed to say in a locker room. I mean, so, you know.
See, that's my deal. The thing with Wawrinka, which already, you know, 2.5 years ago was just, that's the deal, inexcusable. And that's, other than that, I feel like everything else is self-directed and sort of self-sabotaging. You follow him on social media, or you just sort of see him interact with fans, and I can't work up the outrage for that guy because I feel like he is much younger.
You can't work up a good outrage for a guy who tanks matches.
The Stan thing to me was the big one, and I feel like there are a lot of pressures there. He's very, whatever his age is chronologically, it's about half that in terms of emotional maturity. I feel like he's, I don't know. I mean, you see athletes in other sports, and the worst thing you can say is like he plays 2 weeks in a row, gets tired, and can't close out. I don't know.
I'm not talking about getting tired. I'm talking about tanking. That's not a self-inflicted wound. He's doing that to the whole tournament. He's doing it to the fans. He's doing it to television. No. Look, that's what I'm saying. I would love very much for Nick Kyrgios to throw all that stuff off the canoe and live up to himself. And I think he can. And my hope is that in 2018, he finds his way and stops doing the wackadoodle stuff, the nutty stuff, the offensive stuff that mars his greatness. Because I think he's a great player. I think he's charismatic as hell.
Right.
We need him to be at his best.
You had that lengthy interview with him, I think, in D.C. or Cincinnati.
Last summer. Yeah.
Didn't you come away thinking?
I loved him.
I was going to say, fundamental. I mean, again, not everything he does is advisable. Not everything, but fundamentally, good guy.
Oh, look. As I said, I think he is young and raw in a lot of ways.
Right.
But
right.
He's wildly, crazily talented. And I mean, I don't even mind it when he hits, you know, crazy shots between his legs
exactly.
and stuff, because clearly he's just trying to keep himself engaged.
Keep yourself engaged, exactly. Exactly.
In the same way that I thought there were times when John McEnroe blew up on the court because he was getting a little bored. He was winning a little too easily.
Right.
I think that can happen with Nick. It's his way to get, you know, to, in a way, in a crazy way, refocus. So there's a lot about him I am more than willing to forgive. I'm agreeing with you, basically. I'm saying that this is a guy who the sport genuinely needs to be at his best, at least most of the time. That's all. I'm not asking for it. I'm not asking for everything. I mean, but it would be nice.
It's a good ask. I always say, tell me what you think of this crazy theory. One of the most valuable.
I love crazy theories. The more half baked, the better.
No, but feel free to knock this one down. But one of the most valuable assets in tennis right now is Roger Federer's social media. You know why?
You know why though? Tell me.
Because I mean, you know, whatever. We line up to praise the guy, but the message that sends to the rest of the field that you can play at this level and have the pressures and obligations that this guy has and still have thoughts beyond tennis and still be goofy and still be light.
You don't see
Tiger Woods saying, you know, who wants to wear a Bears costume? Or I mean, it's what if you're following, you talked about those players today who have a good attitude. If you're 20 years old and you see that Roger friggin' Federer at age 36 can still do clap emojis when he comes across the funny YouTube video, it's really endearing, and I think is sort of encapsulates what a lot of people like about the guy. But I also just think it sends such a great message to the rest of the field that you don't have to give up a certain sort of essential happiness to do this job really well.
I cannot agree with you anymore. And again, we both covered an awful lot of athletes in a whole bunch of sports, John, but I have never met anyone like him, ever, ever. That somebody who brings, apart from all of the talent and passion, he brings so much joy to the game. And in fact, I asked Nick Kyrgios that last summer. I said, of all of the things that Roger Federer has done, especially this year, especially at this age, after everything he's already won, after all he's already accomplished, the fact that he continues to find such joy in tennis, is that what you admire most, and is that what you would want more than anything else?
Right.
And Kyrgios allowed that, you know, yes, there's no one like Roger. Kyrgios is not built like that, and I don't know how anybody after all of this time can still walk so lightly and with so much, again, with so much joy, as he does on and off the court. I mean, the things, the little things that he does right every single day. And it's just in him, like the grain in wood. It doesn't seem like, it's why, and I think Grigor Dimitrov has an awful lot of that.
Right,
It's an instinct. It's just in there. It's a bone deep awareness and self-knowledge.
I think it's so authentic. Like, I don't think someone's whispering in his ear, hey, I mean, I heard a great story recently where, you know, he walks past a doubles guy and the guy doesn't even know if he knows who he is. And Roger says, you know, hey, are you playing with Rajiv Ram or did you switch over to, Robin Klaassen? I just made up those names, but he knows the goings on and the intrigue for the number 56 ranked doubles player. He's just part of the culture. Why wouldn't I know that?
That's exactly right. It's so taking when he does that. Remember a couple of years ago, he ends up playing a guy ranked, 774 in the world or something, a guy who came, the Brit, who came through pre-qualies.
Oh, yeah, Marcus Willis. Yeah, Marcus Willis, sure.
Roger knew that story.
Yeah,
Roger,
exactly.
You know,
I
loved it. Roger said, oh, yeah, I've been reading about him.
Right.
I've been reading about him. Like, you're trying to win Wimbledon, but you want to know your second round opponent.
Right.
Like you're caught up in the Marcus Willis.
No, you remember. He's like, it's a great story. Someone should option this for a movie. Can you?
Oh boy.
There's a. It's pretty funny.
We're lucky.
We're lucky to have that guy. Lucky. All right. This was almost an hour.
And it's going to be a good Australian. I know it's going to be. You're going to. I hope you have the good sense to chop this up. But
hell no.
I'm willing to. I want to tell you that I'm very. I think it's going to be a very interesting 2018.
You know what happens every time at these events? The first few days are there's some sort of scandal and there's some negative story and there's some upset and when will tennis this and American tennis will. By the middle of the week, it's sort of wheat gets separated from chaff. The adults, it really, and these things always end up on dignified notes. And the first, Demir Dokic is throwing fish. And it ends up with the Williams sisters winning the title. It always works out that way. So I'm with you.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun, and I'm delighted that I'll be with you the whole trip.
Oh, likewise. I'm looking forward.
We'll have some laughs.
We'll have laughs and good coffee. What more do you want?
Deal.
Go pad your mileage account. I'm envious of your frequent flying, but
I don't know. I'm more and more. I'm thinking that to belong to so many million mile clubs is a sign that something's terribly wrong. That I'm up in the air so much.
You know what?
But that can't be healthy. But it's fun.
There's a book about that. And the Margaret Court piece airs real quick. I should know this, so I don't have it in front of me.
The first real sports of 2018, it airs on January 30th. The women's final is the 17th, the men's is the 18th. So this runs a couple of days after that. Craig Tiley, the tournament director, is going to speak to us in the first week for our piece. So we'll have a fourth voice to go along with Martina's, Billie Jean's, and Margaret's.
Okay.
So, and let me just tell you one quick thing. Barrett Remack is the producer of this, a good friend of yours and mine.
Sold.
Yes, and Barrett had not met Billie Jean before we sat with her a couple of weeks ago. And
really?
Well, more than anything, she came away and said, what I like about Billie is that you can watch her think. I would say something to Billie Jean about, and it's so true, because Billie gets into these sort of reveries, where she, and then she'll say, wait a minute, I got to think about that. And, you know, I mean, Martina knew exactly how she felt right away.
Right, right.
Billie would give something a think, and Barrett loved that you could watch her think.
That's so un-Vogue-ish.
And you can. It's pretty cool. Anyway, we'll see how it goes.
That's a great observation. I wish we did more of that. Sadly, out of step with the times, I fear, but good on Billie. This was fun. It was great.
I always, my friend.
If I buy coffee, we'll do this mid-tournament.
All right.
And watch the 80 minutes. Watch the Becker film. I'll give you my login.
I'll watch the Becker film.
You can steal my login.
I'll get back to you on that.
All right.
All right, very good.
Safe travels.
All right.
All right. See you, my friend. Take care. All right, that's it for this week. Thank you to our guest, Mary Carrillo. Thanks, as always, to tennis producer extraordinaire Jamie Lasanti. Some of you have asked, why don't we do longer podcasts? Well, that one, Jamie, tell me if I'm wrong. Did we hit the 1 hour mark on that one?
Just about, yes.
Just about. Time flies when you're talking tennis and other topics with Mary Carrillo. Jamie Lasanti, your takeaways from having just listened to an hour of free-form tennis talk.
It was great.
Give me your headline.
Well, first of all, Mary's very fired up about her conversation with Margaret Court, and she puts on a good preview for us to all listen and watch. I'm interested in that. Headline number one. Headline number two, Australian Open headlines. The one thing that I didn't really realize until now, Simona Halep, star contrast this year and last year at the Australian Open.
She is the top seed, and she's defending virtually nothing. I think it was sort of a nasal injury. I mean, I think last year she was not moving well, but also had some, some residual issues from a surgery, and lost in the first round, I believe, without looking this up, I believe it was to Shelby Rogers.
It was.
Ooh, you looked that up? Nice win for Shelby Rogers. We haven't heard much from Shelby Rogers. But no, I think Mary's pick of Simona Halep is a good one. It would be nice for her if she won. I can say Simona Halep, as Mary said, has some rough defeats, but she's very admirable and honorable in those defeats, and talks about them openly. And I think that's a sign of a fully formed adult, but I think that's also sort of an earmark of a champion, that you confront these things, however unfortunate. I think Simona Halep has a real chance to win. Going back to Margaret Court, did that make sense, the point I was trying to make about drawing a line between what people did from Pete Rose to Yawkey to, you know, pick your Confederate monument, to someone who today, if you tap them on the shoulder and ask them, they would still hold these views? I mean, that's one reason I have no... I think there's a debate to be had about historical figures who may have acted offensively today, and we can assess their behavior in with some historical sensitivity. But I mean, big difference between that and Margaret Court in the present tense.
At the very basic level, there's not an asterisk on, you know, for everyone that you mentioned, there was no asterisk on, you know, their plates and stadiums and their, you know, nameplates and all these things. There's not an asterisk that says they said this and they did that. I mean, those things are there, and they're being honored for athletic achievements at the bare minimum, right? It helps if they are good people and they say nice things. I understand what you're saying, and I just think now, today, it's very hard for people to separate the two. You know, you guys talked about Roger Federer and how he's just exemplary in that respect. And so when you have someone like him who will not only be remembered for everything he's done athletically, but also because of the kind of person he is, it's hard to put those two people in the same Hall of Fame room when, you know, people have said things in the present. So
I heard an interesting theory about these Confederate monuments and about past figures and whether we should tear down statues or rename buildings. And one of them was the behavior that today, through today's lens, would be offensive, was that central to who they were? So George Washington owning slaves, unfortunate, regrettable. Today it would be outrageous. But was this central to how we think about George Washington? Perhaps not. Someone like John C. Calhoun, who, the legacy is tied to his views on slavery, that's another story. So I thought that was an interesting way to sort of assess this, about where we draw this line and what someone where we really need to rethink how we think about them versus someone who was acting in a way that was appropriate at the time that, as we've evolved, is no longer appropriate. This inquiry about whether were these offensive views central to who they were and what they're famous for, it's a thought exercise as much as anything, but I think it's an interesting way to take on this question.
And for players too, because then, you know, they think about that when the question comes up, you know, do you want to play in this court named after this person, or do you want to, you know, associate yourself? So it like you said, interesting thought.
It would be interesting to see if any player, back to Margaret Court, interesting to see whether any player says, you know what, I'm not comfortable played on a court named Donald.
And that was our story of the first week last year. And it sort of trickled away, and someone asked in the mailbag this week, you know, like, kind of whatever happened to that, right?
Yeah, right. Whatever happened to this protest. Anyway, among the many sub-stories that we will look forward to at the 2018 Australian Open, we will do another podcast from Melbourne. Jamie, I wish you were coming to produce it in person.
Me too.
Maybe next year. I will. We'll do it off our iPhone, but don't tell anyone. All right, that does it for this week. Thanks again to Mary for a fun visit. Thanks to Jamie. Thanks for all of your suggestions. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are sold. We will talk again from Melbourne. Enjoy the first few rounds of the Australian Open, everyone.